You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
It's my honor today to moderate the conversation among our panelists and with you. MEI and SAIS are very pleased to welcome you to this discussion on prospects for U.S.-Russia coordination on Syria. After a late summer break, the Middle East Institute is back to a rich program of public events. Next Friday, September 16, at midday, my colleague Marvin Weinbaum will lead a discussion on the evolving threats posed by Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Haqqani network in Afghanistan. At the end of this month, MEI will host its seventh full-day conference on Turkey, and our 70th anniversary annual conference is coming up on November 15 and 16. So please visit the MEI website and register to attend all of these events. Our topic today is Syria and the roles that Washington and Moscow can play in ending the conflict there. This issue has seen intense diplomacy in recent weeks. Presidents Obama and Putin spoke about Syria during their meeting at the G20 summit in China a few days ago. Mr. Kerry and Mr. Lavrov, I assume, are meeting right now, or as we speak, in Geneva, and they met before in the past week. Technical teams from both countries met in Geneva. It's still unclear whether Washington and Moscow will be able to iron out the remaining differences, especially the ones focused on Aleppo. The task is made more complex by events on Syria's patchwork of battlefronts, which are trending right now in the regime's favor, including in Aleppo, where the regime has established the siege, re-established the siege over the city. The task is also complicated by the political and military actions of states in the region, most prominently Turkey. Any student of conflict resolution and negotiation, and I'm sure there are plenty of them in this room, know that a multi-sided, multi-issue, protracted conflict is difficult to solve to start with, and as time progresses, the task of peacemaking becomes even more difficult. We also have a problem with the political timetable. For the next few months, this timetable does not help the peacemakers' task. We have U.S. elections in less than 2 months and a new U.N. Secretary General to be chosen at the end of this year. The new U.S. administration and the next U.N. Secretary General will engage in reviews of their respective policies in Syria, among other conflict areas, and might or might not take a different look at the policy in place. As you can see, we have many issues today to discuss. Fortunately, I'm joined by three remarkable experts with deep and direct experience on the subject matter. They are Ambassador Robert Ford, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, Roger Kangas, academic dean and professor in the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, and Henri Barki, director of the Middle East Program at the Wilson Center. Their bios are with the invitation, so I'm not going to go in detail about each of their bios, which are extremely impressive. All of us here, and our colleague who just walked in, Paul Salim, took part a month ago in a Track 2 dialogue involving 16 U.S. and Russian experts. The focus of the discussion was the Syria-Iraq conflict axis. We spent more time talking about Syria than Iraq, and we had a very interesting discussion about the Kurdish issue. I forgot to mention that also our colleague Charles Lister, who is in the room, was also part of the discussion. The dialogue, the Track 2 dialogue, was co-organized by the Middle East Institute Initiative for Track 2 Dialogue and the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, and we hope we will be continuing with this Track 2 next year. Now, let's go to the task at hand. I have asked each of my colleagues to speak for 5 to 7 minutes at the start, addressing one particular angle to this issue of prospects for coordination, U.S.-Russia coordination on Syria. After their presentations, I will pose initially one round of questions to each of them or as a group. And if I feel the conversation warrants a second round of questions, I will do that. And then I will open it for questions and answer with the audience. I'm going to be reserving about 40 minutes. So for those of you who have questions, please, you know, I think we will have time to address them. And I would like to make this session as interactive as possible between this group and yourself. Robert will be discussing the ongoing U.S.-Russia negotiations against the background of evolving conflict dynamics on the ground in Syria. And what types of challenges do these dynamics pose for the future prospect of U.S.-Russia negotiation on Syria? Roger Kangas will follow and will discuss the prospects for U.S.-Russia coordination on Syria within the broader context of the U.S.-Russia relationship. And Henri Barki will share with us his own take on how the Turkish military intervention incursion in northern Syria impacts these prospects for U.S.-Russia coordination, for good or bad. So the floor is yours, Robert.
Thank you, Rhonda. First, it's nice to be back at SAIS. I think there are a lot of students here who are starting classes. Good luck. I'm so glad now I teach instead of having to write papers. So I'm going to talk for 5 minutes, and I have three topics I want to address. Number one, how the United States and Russia analyze the essential Syria problem and why that makes cooperation and coordination difficult. Then the second thing I want to talk about is relative leverage, United States and Russia, and how that also makes coordination and cooperation difficult. And then finally, I want to just throw out, Secretary Kerry is with Minister Lavrov now, and they're talking again, and maybe they'll come up with a deal. And so my question that I want to talk about at the end is, so what? So first, different analyses. I've sat in a lot of meetings myself between secretaries of state and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov about Syria, and the Russian analysis is different from the American analysis about the essence of the problem. The American analysis is the Syrian government under Bashar al-Assad and the ruling clique needed to reform. There were expectations among a young population, burgeoning population, drought, et cetera, unemployment, that caused problems, and the regime did not adapt. And without political reform, without economic reform, you cannot address the underlying instability. In fact, the lack of reform encourages extremism. It helps extremist groups like Al-Qaeda, like the Islamic State, recruit. And you will even see to this day the Obama administration, seeing the president himself, mention that in press discussions, media discussions this year. The Russian analysis that I've heard both in official conversations and unofficial conversations is that this essentially is a military problem, that there do need to be some changes in the Syrian government in Damascus, but they're talking more about tweaking rather than deep reform. That to the Russian point of view, the problem of extremism in Syria is first and foremost a security challenge that needs to be dealt with on a security level. The American response to that is, but if you don't deal with the underlying repression economic problems, you can't fight your way out of the extremism problem. The Russians will simply say, but if you don't fix the security problem, you can't even begin to tweak the regime. And we've literally gone around this chicken and egg for years. But that is the fundamental analytical difference. The Russians have an emphasis on military first. The Americans have an emphasis on there needs to be reform. A whole Geneva communique from 2012 that Secretary Clinton negotiated at the time with Lavrov. So that's the first point. Second point, leverage. Complicating coordination is an inability of both Russia and the United States to deliver cessation of hostilities, to deliver humanitarian access, to deliver substantial, serious political negotiations. On the Russian side, I do not think the Russians are fully supportive of all of the things that the Syrian government does in terms of bombing, in terms of blocking humanitarian access into the many, many besieged communities that the opposition controls. I have heard myself from United Nations officials that are on the ground that in many cases the Russian ambassador was playing a very helpful role trying to get UN-led convoys into besieged communities in places like Homs and suburban Damascus, but that the Syrian government was often obstreperous. My own experience in Iraq when we had 150,000 American soldiers in Iraq and could not control every little thing the Iraqi government did, I have some sympathy with the Russian situation. It is not like the Russians can snap their fingers and the next day the Syrian government implements whatever the Russians want them to do. It's made harder for the Russians by the Iranian role. The Iranians are providing huge assistance to the Syrian government now, even organizing fighting groups from Iraqi Shia, from Afghan Shia refugees in Iran to go onto the front lines of Aleppo. By the way, Aleppo is not the capital of the Islamic State. And so that further reduces Russian leverage. I do not mean to say the Russians have no leverage. That is not what I'm saying. And I do not mean to say that the Russians have not helped the Syrian government. They have helped the Syrian government enormously. But there's a difference between being helpful and being able to give an instruction and see it carried out. The Russians have a problem that way with leverage. Now, on the American side, it's the same thing, especially with the armed opposition. The armed opposition is, at this point, basically strongly distrusts the United States and is not willing to just follow it and do whatever we would like it to do. The best expert I know of is Charles Lister on this. And Charles, please disagree with me. If you think I'm wrong, speak up. But I don't think the Americans can easily convince the armed opposition to respect a ceasefire, to allow UN-led humanitarian convoys into the handful of either Shia or Alawi enclaves that are surrounded up in northwestern Syria. And so the Americans, too, have a leverage problem. Turkey has its own agenda. Saudi Arabia has its own agenda. And the Obama administration's difficulties with Saudi Arabia and Turkey are well known. And so both governments are trying to negotiate a cessation of hostility and get the people on their so-called two sides lined up. Both sides have a leverage problem. That complicates seeing the terms of any agreement coming out of a Lavrov-Kerry meeting in Geneva, seeing the terms of that agreement respected. Ceasefire, humanitarian aid, and of course, ultimately, political negotiations. So then, as I look at what's going on in the news, and I'll end on this point, it might be a little controversial. It is conceivable, given the American concern with al-Qaeda's burgeoning influence in Syria, and the Russian insistence that this is a military issue, first and foremost, and striking groups that are fighting the Assad regime as a priority, in this case, extremists such as al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, I can imagine that the United States and Russia might agree to do some kind of coordinated military campaign against these extremists. I think that's entirely within the realm of the feasible, although I would note that Secretary of Defense Ash Carter and CIA Director John Brennan have expressed some skepticism in public statements over the last 10 days. I don't know that this is going to happen tomorrow or the next day, but I can imagine it within the realm of the conceivable. But so what? I share the American analysis that ultimately this is not first and foremost a military problem, that this is in fact a problem of deeper expectations among a young population that want change, that want accountable government, that want hope, want economic opportunity. Bombing Nusra with the Russians does not reconstruct Syria. Bombing Nusra with the Russians does not end the armed opposition's struggle against Assad. Bombing Nusra and the Islamic State with the Russians will not give hope to refugees that they can return home. most of the refugees, over 70%, fled because of Syrian government bombing. And so if you can't make the other parts of the deal, the cessation of hostilities and humanitarian access, and if you can't get a political negotiation started, I think bombing Nusra and the Islamic State, while they have some advantages to us in terms of our national security and making it more difficult for groups like the Islamic State and Nusra to use Syria as a launching pad to conduct terror attacks in the West, that may have an advantage. It does not address the underlying problems in Syria, and ultimately just leads us in a long-term bombing campaign from which I don't really know how we extract ourselves. So on that very cheerful note, Rhonda.
Thank you. Roger, please.
Thank you. And let me... first, sort of two initial comments. One, as well, I'm happy to be back here at SAIS. I was very fortunate and honored to teach here a while back, I'll just say in the last century, previous century, but it's always good to be back. And secondly, as Rhonda said, I'm with the Near East South Asia Center at National Defense University, so I have to give that wonderful government disclaimer. These are my views, not that of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, National Defense University, or the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. Got that in. And the point is pretty straightforward, because I share Robert's pessimism, or at least concern raised. And when I look at negotiations, agreements, what we're seeing in Geneva, as well as what has been an ongoing military-to-military dialogue. I mean, the militaries have been speaking now for a while and have been attempting to coordinate, and in fact, on some levels, have coordinated efforts. I still look at it with perhaps a bit of unfortunate skepticism. And part of this really relates to the task that I was given, which is, you know, so what does this mean in the broader context of U.S.-Russian relations? And I can sum this up by saying that we really have a disconnect in terms of the narratives we're presenting about ourselves and our missions in the region, as well as the goals, missions of the other side. How the U.S. is presenting Russia, how we are presenting ourselves, unfortunately don't connect well with the Russian narratives. And as a result, we're really speaking at cross purposes. For us, a solution is to simply ignore the differences and march on ahead. And we've done this before. We've called it a reset. We've looked at efforts where we've said, well, Russians ultimately want to be just like us. They want to be democracies. They have a similar mindset than we do. So any differences, discrepancies, we're going to ignore, and we're going to work in tandem. We can juxtapose that with the perspective of, well, this is Cold War II. This is the sort of the successor state of the Soviet Union. Therefore, anything they say, we have to automatically discount. We have to automatically assume there's a nefarious purpose behind it. And unfortunately, from our approach, from the American approach, we often balance between these two rather extreme views, and perhaps somewhere in the middle is something closer to the truth. And what's that truth? Well, the truth is I don't want to say simple, because... but I have to say that so I can keep it now to 4 minutes, or 4.5 minutes, which is when we look at our engagement in the region, and the points that Robert said are absolutely true, you know, when we look at this as a mission of reconstruction, as a humanitarian component, there is an element or an effort to reimagine a Syria that is a democracy that's representative of the community writ large. When we look at the military component, we're trying to fit that in with what's ultimately a counterterrorism or counter-extremist campaign. We're fighting ISIL or Daesh. We're fighting al-Nusra. We are fighting specific groups. At Central Command and in other military organizations, this dominates the attention, the actual tactical, practical efforts of combating these groups. The regime change element, if we want to use that phrase, and I know that's a loaded phrase, plays a part, obviously, and the discussion of whether Assad has to go now, whether he's part of a transition, et cetera, this is debated among academics. In the policy circles, I would say, the political leadership, it's a little more certain Assad has to go. So we come at it with a certain perspective. We have these sets of questions on one hand, and somewhere on the other hand is our relationship with Russia. this relationship, as I've just said, is imbued with this approach of whether it's a Cold War a return or whether this is a partner we can work with. Can we actually look into this president's eyes and see his soul and understand it? We've tried that. It hasn't quite worked. It's the same guy in charge. And whether it's the current administration, and I would argue as we go into the next administration, they're going to be working with some individuals who have pretty defined views of the U.S. What are these views? And this is the other part now that makes this a bit of a conundrum. From the Russian perspective, when they look at the campaign in Syria and in the broader context of U.S.-Russian relations, they actually see these linked. They see these as part of a much larger mosaic of Russia's international presence and international security policy. First and foremost, it really represents its view of itself. How does Russia see Russia? Are they a great power? Are they a global power? Are they a regional power? Are they, a power for change? These narratives go on and on and on in the Russian media, Russian publications. Quite frankly, conferences are held on this. What kind of power is Russia? This ties into its relationship with the West, which is a lot more complicated than we want to imagine. In the U.S., we don't really think of it in terms of this broader sort of march of history, so to speak, of is the West someone to, from the Russian point of view, is the West a region to look at with suspicion? Is it a partner to engage with in certain elements, certain areas, business transactions, security transactions? What is it? When the U.S., I'll take us as an example, in our State Department, when the LGBT agenda is something we are attempting to really show in other countries how this can be a force of good and how we can look at diversity and how we can look at human rights. From the Russian perspective, this is viewed as a negative. This is viewed as, part of the corruption of Western society. And this goes anything from, whether it's our music, sort of cultural norms, habits, etc. These are almost regularly presented in a negative light out of Moscow. And so in many ways, Russia is a protector of Orthodox, capital O and small o, values and faiths. They are a protector of norms of human civilization that the West is really discarding. And it's not just the US, by the way. What they say about the Europeans is just as disparaging. So we look at these issues, this us versus them dichotomy. They can engage with us, but it's going to be in certain areas where they feel that they have control and leverage. One of these is counterterrorism, sort of a third area of interest. Believe it or not, this actually is a real agenda in Moscow. Terrorism, extremism, if we want to use that phrase, is a concern. And they have experience in this, of course. It's gone back for decades in the post-Soviet space, whether they look at the Chechen experience as a war on terrorism, which is now the narrative they will present. Their campaign in Afghanistan back in the 1980s, in the late Soviet period, is now really recast today in this decade as a campaign against violent extremism and terrorism, and they look at the result in the 1990s as proof of that narrative. And so for them to say that their campaign, their activity in Syria, is really about terrorism, well, there's an element of truth to it, but we have to caution. It's a limited, focused effort, and I agree with Robert, we're looking at a military measure to not just help the Assad regime and to ensure its somewhat security or stability, but also to go after certain targets. Now, who they deem a terrorist is a bit broader than who we would deem as a terrorist, and of course, why they're targeting groups that aren't in the ones that we would see as appropriate. From the Russian perspective, these are more than appropriate, and in fact, the ideal situation is we fight them there so we don't have to fight them back in our own territory. We don't have to fight them in our homeland. Using almost word for word the language that they knew the U.S. used in 2001 and 2002. It's interesting to see some phrases recur now in the Russian media and in Russian public discourse that we used 15-plus years ago. And then finally, there's this fourth element I would just want to add, which is their Middle East policy. And I think Robert outlined it quite well. I would just add from the Russian perspective, it ties into these other elements because, of course, as they can engage and maintain themselves in Syria, as they can be relevant, it gives them a couple of points. That is, it gives them a seat at the table in any post-conflict discussion and, quite frankly, in any conflict discussion. We wouldn't be having a Kerry Lavrov discussion if Russia weren't so engaged. they have a seat at the table now. They want to feel treated as an equal. This ties back to that sense of self, of course. They're not a destitute country that is experiencing a collapse that they did in the 1990s. They are an assertive, powerful nation, one of the countries in the world to be reckoned with by being engaged in the Middle East, even really in a pretty modest fashion. And if you look at the cost, if you look at the cost Russia is spending, engaging in Syria, it's actually quite modest compared to, say, what the U.S. has and continues to spend. So on the cheap, they're treated as an equal. That's not a bad bargain if I'm in Moscow. It allows me to become a player in the global community. Now, do they continue to tie this with relations with NATO and NATO enlargement and other questions that vex them? On occasion, you get this, and you'll see some interesting narratives that do tie this broader web together. We tend not to do it. Russian analysts, Russian political figures do. And so I would couch their Middle East policy in this broader context. With that, I'm going to leave my comments as is, and we can continue onward.
Thank you. Henri, you are on.
Thank you, Anna. Thanks for inviting me. I have to be honest. When you invited me, I should have been a little bit honest with you and say that, in fact, I'm very confused about what's going on with respect to Turkey and Syria and the United States at the moment. I'll try to make as much sense as I can at the moment. I want to pick up on something Roger said about, he said there's a disconnect in the narrative between Russia and the United States on Syria. And I would argue that in Turkey and the United States, there is actually no disconnect on the narrative, but there's a complete disconnect on goals and actions. Mm-hmm. So you have this very bizarre situation where both countries are saying approximately the same things about Assad, about ISIS and Daesh, but in fact, what they're doing and what the policies they're pursuing are completely at odds with each other, and they're making, I have to say, putting a smiley face. You saw Vice President Biden in Turkey, and then President Obama and Erdogan talking on the edge of the G20 summit. You would think that there's really no problem. And I guess this is what diplomacy is all about, but I'll say something about that in a minute. But let me just say that, in fact, there was a moment when the narrative was the same between the two countries, and all fell apart, essentially, October 2014 over Kobani, when the United States decided to essentially go after ISIS in the town of Kobani. The town of Kobani was being besieged. Kobani is a Syrian Kurdish town, was being defended by the PYD, which is essentially a Syrian Kurdish organization, but was actually formed by the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party in Turkey, and the two have a very symbiotic relationship. The United States' decision to hit ISIS was a decision that was taken on the spur of the moment. There was no plan before. It just happened that ISIS committed essentially a huge strategic error by massing an enormous amount of equipment that it had captured from the Iraqi army in Mosul and decided to make a show of it. And then someone in the Pentagon probably said, you know, we can actually destroy a lot of this stuff if we attack it. And so President Obama decided to do it. And what I understand, against the advice of some of his close advisors, who thought that Turkey would be upset, and they happened to be right, but I think Obama was right in hitting ISIS then. The point is, that's the moment in which the narrative changed. I mean, the similarity in the narrative changed. And Turkish and American priorities in Syria also changed. Until then, both had Assad as their number one priority. For the United States, ISIS was number two. It wasn't very clear what for the Turks. By de facto, I would say that ISIS was number two, even though we know that a lot of the ISIS fighters who had come through Turkey, not necessarily to join ISIS first, but other groups, and then migrated to ISIS. That said, the Kurds were not even necessarily on the radar screen for the Turks until Kobani. what was happening also in Turkey at the same time, and it's very important to understand, is that to Erdogan's credit, there was a peace process going on between Turkey and the PKK. I mean, Erdogan did something that no other Turkish politician has ever done, which is to talk to the PKK directly. And he had, and there was even an agreement that was signed in the Dolmabahçe Palace between representatives of the Turkish government, ministers included, Kurdish politicians who had gone and participated in those negotiations with none other than the devil incarnate, Abdullah Öcalan, who sits in an island in the Marmara Sea. So this was actually, I mean, you have to put it in context. This is an enormous step that was taken by the Turkish government, by Erdogan, I should say, against all grain in Turkish politics, and he took an enormous chance, and it was working. It was working until the Kobani incident happened. For Erdogan, I don't know ultimately what his goal was, whether or not he was trying to impose a peace on the Kurds that was acceptable to him and surely had to be acceptable to them as well, but essentially was one in which he gave the minimum amount of concessions. That said, what Kobani did was, Kobani was an enormous shot in the confidence of Kurds everywhere, especially Turkish Kurds, because of the close links between Turkish and Syrian Kurds, because the Syrian Kurds essentially are the creation of the PKK. And he saw this essentially as changing the balances in Turkey between what he was trying to achieve, between the PKK and the Turkish state. And he gave essentially the PKK another area, another contiguous, adjacent to Turkey, another state that maybe just like the KRG in Iraq. That was far too difficult for him to accept. Erdogan has no problems with the KRG. I mean, actually, they get along famously well. I will argue that even he might support independence for Iraqi Kurdistan one day. But the problem was Syria. And it is over this that he essentially stopped the peace process with the PKK in Turkey. And then from then on, you see now the war in Turkey started again immediately thereafter in 2015, and it's been going on with tremendous casualties, tremendous destruction especially in Kurdish majority regions of Turkey. But that's been the ongoing, if you want, background story. So with that, what happened in Syria is suddenly Erdogan's priorities in Syria changed. Assad was no longer number one. It was the PKK / PYD, whatever it was. And increasingly, that has come to dominate completely Turkish policy. And Turkish policy in Syria today is maybe 80%, 90% about preventing the PYD from achieving anything, right? And Assad and ISIS are essentially kind of footnotes to the policy. So in that sense, you can see the divergence between American priorities and Turkish priorities in this particular, and the twain shall never meet. And in fact, this has become very, very difficult to manage. And we're seeing it essentially on a daily basis. Now, the funny part about this, and the reason why I was, I said at the beginning I was somewhat confused, is if you read the Turkish press, did you know that the United States and Turkey are going to start an operation against Raqqa together, a military operation? And I'm trying to figure out, and since now 90% of the Turkish press is controlled by Erdogan, you're asking, I mean, what is it, the common tea that they're drinking must have something laced in it, but because the CENTCOM commander says the other day, we're not going to go after Raqqa, Raqqa is no longer a priority, Mosul is a priority. I mean, there is no operation in Raqqa as far as I tried to ask this morning. I was at the State Department. Somebody, a friend of ours, was being sworn in, a Middle East guy. So there were all these Middle East hands. So I kept asking, is there going to be an operation against Raqqa? From what they could tell me, no. So you have this weird discussion going on in the Turkish press, which has no basis for reality. But what the Turks are trying to do is find essentially a cover, if you want, for their own operations in Syria, and in fact, they have crossed the border. They took Jarablus. They are now 5 to 8 kilometers south of the Turkish border, on the way south. They're not going to go to Raqqa because Raqqa is too well defended, and and the United States does not want them to go towards Raqqa. But it's not clear to me that the United States can essentially even stop the Turks from doing what it is they would like to do. What will stop the Turks from doing what it is they would like to do is Turkey's own capabilities. Look, this is a Turkish military that lost 46% of its general staff. In addition to the 146 generals who have been cashiered and arrested, you have thousands of officers, colonels, majors, etc., who also have been cashiered. This is a military who's going through an enormous transition, and it's not a military that you can suddenly take into a foreign adventure anytime soon because it will not perform very well. And in fact, I think the Turkish leadership is quite aware of that. But to sum up, what I would like to say is that, in fact, there is a Turkish strategy now. But the Turkish strategy in Syria now has nothing to do with Assad and nothing to do with ISIS, and has all to do with the Kurds. But it is part of a domestic and, shall we say, Syrian and Iraqi policy on the Kurds. So when you look at the sum total of what Erdogan is doing, is he's putting now enormous amount of pressure on Kurds, not with the exception of the Iraqi Kurds, anywhere. Kurds in Turkey, whether it is politicians who are part of the legal political party, HDP, whether it is political activists, whether it is yesterday they fired 11,000 teachers because of their Kurdish sympathies. So it is an all-out fight against Kurds, PKK, but Kurds in general in Turkey, together with military operations, etc. What they're doing in Syria is part of that, I would suggest, is part of the same strategy. It is to put as much pressure on the PKK as possible, to force the PKK, my guess is, to go for a unilateral ceasefire so that Erdogan can say his military strategy worked and he wants at least psychologically to defeat the PKK. He knows, and that's the reason he did talk to Öcalan, he knows he cannot defeat the Kurds militarily. That ship sailed a long time ago. So it's a question of reconfiguring the domestic political environment in such a way that he can say he defeated PKK and then reimpose, essentially go back to the negotiating table and maybe impose his solution on a much more weakened Kurdish polity, both military and politics. So in that sense, Erdogan's and Turkey's policies have completely changed. So it's going to be very difficult, essentially, for the United States now to be able to carve a strategy in terms of what to do about Syria. The last point here I would like to say, look, it's been 5 years since the Syrian civil war started, and we would not, this particular expose I just did, correct or incorrect, doesn't matter, we would never have thought of doing it at the beginning of the Syrian crisis. The way things are going, the Syrian crisis may last another 5 years. 5 years from now, if we're still here, if we want to have a meeting here, we'll be talking about a very different set of conditions. I mean, to a large extent, it's the length of this crisis in Syria that is actually affecting everything and changing policies.
Thank you. Let me quickly address a question to you, Henri. The elephant in the Syrian room is Iran. And so I assume Erdogan is not happy with Iran in Aleppo. And suddenly we are hearing of KDPI activities, you know, in Tehran. And so getting weapons, becoming active. I'm not trying to be here, do the conspiracy kind of theory, who's funding them. But how does Erdogan view Iran? What's the drivers now of the Turkish-Iranian relation, if we can put it going forward? It has been a working relationship. They disagree fundamentally on Assad, but we are seeing, you know, some kind of rapprochement happening with Fadl. Turkish-Iran.
So you're seeing a rapprochement, you're saying?
I mean, some kind of a warming up. On Assad, they are still But, for example, I think the idea that Ankara now is of the opinion that Assad can have a role in the transition period is something that Iran welcomes, you know, whereas we see yesterday Al-Jubeir, after his meeting with the foreign minister of Turkey, saying, oh, we are on the same, you know, position here, although they are
same,
not.
It seems to me everybody's on the
same
side.
But they are not
on
this. So where do you see this Turkish-Iranian relationship evolve, given the role of Iran in Aleppo and the likelihood that Iran is going to be staying in Aleppo for a long time to come?
Aleppo?
Which is not the capital of ISIS, by the way.
Look, I think just like there's been a rapprochement with Russia, you've seen a rapprochement with Iran for essentially the same reason. A, because the fact that the United States and Turkey are at odds over the Kurds in Syria. And I should say here, by the way, I don't think the United States is there because of its love for the Kurds. God forbid. I mean, that's not what we're going to do. But it's there because ISIS is our number one target, and these are the only guys who have defeated ISIS. But that has created this rift between Turkey and Ankara. I'm sorry, between Turkey and the United States, and therefore it has pushed Erdogan to essentially make his peace with Putin and open up the doors to Iran. And look, I mean, there's a realistic reason. I mean, Erdogan also can read the tea leaves and say, look, Assad is not about to go. Right? Maybe 2-3 years ago, at the beginning, people thought Assad did not have much of a longevity, but now you have to make the best deal you can make out of the situation you have. And given the fact that his priority is no longer Assad, it's the Kurds, and given the fact that the Iranians, if they wanted to, could play havoc with the Kurds, it's a way of making sure that they don't intervene. And look, and he's very good at changing on a dime. Look, when the Russian plane was shot down, Erdogan said, "We would do it again if it happens." Right? And suddenly, oh my God, it wasn't our fault. It was these awful Gulenist officers who did it. I mean, if you believe that, I'll sell you a Brooklyn Bridge. But the point is, he's very capable of switching very, very quickly. And that's what he's doing now.
So, same question, but from the Iran-Russia relationship and how the drivers of that relationship in the Middle East and how does it impact the U.S., you know, Russia coordination or prospects for coordination?
I think you were right. Everyone's on the same page, on opposite pages, changing pages. It's transactional. And I think this is a word probably should have used a bit earlier. When we think in terms of, you know, a number of the participants in the region and looking at, you know, the Russian engagement in the region, it's looking for opportunities, looking for areas where it's a low-cost, high-return situation, if possible. And take advantage of it. Their relationship with Iran in this context, it's complicated in part because it's really been a testy love-hate relationship, right? I mean, we think in terms of Soviet Union as a funder of Iraq, post-Soviet Russia engaging with Iran on certain issues, collaborating against the Taliban in Afghanistan, opposing each other in different situations. Russia vehemently opposed to the Iranian nuclear program. You're not going to find many officials in Russia who would actually support the notion of a nuclear-weaponed Iran. And so P5 plus 1 or EU 3 plus 3, depending on who's in the audience, Russia's in favor of that. This is all good stuff. So they look upon Iran with some concern, some trepidation. However, they engage in this area and, in fact, in a similar or parallel line with the U.S., and now we look at these other adventures, the Iranian engagement in Syria. Right now, they're together. Both have some similar goals. And, you know, keeping Assad in power, I would say the motivation is different. Quite frankly, if Assad goes, Russian leaders aren't going to lose any sleep over this. But if they can maintain support for him, they at least give the image that they are supporting a friend and an ally and that they are a loyal actor in the region, which, by the way, is something they love to hold against us. The Russian narrative in the region, which resonates well, is you didn't support people like Mubarak. We support our friends and we keep, you know, we honor our word. And you even go to GCC countries who will say, yes, Russians actually honor, you know, their word. So they play this quite well. How that relates to Iran, quite frankly, it's still a limited set of levers. Iran frustrates Russia. During the nuclear discussions, Iranian bargaining positions frustrated the Russian positions and Russian negotiators to no end. On trade deals, on energy cooperation, Iran and Russia don't necessarily see eye to eye. They will work together towards an agreement. It'll fall flat. Production levels, things like that, that Russia and Iran don't necessarily work together. And so we find where they look for opportunities, they'll have successes, but we can start to point to as many failures. On Syria, we're looking at a situation where they are, at least at the moment, in agreement. If we expand this further, let's be honest, groups like Hezbollah and others aren't exactly the Russian cup of tea. And these are organizations and these are proxies that they would find not quite to their liking. They would rather that those not be a key focus or an element of the Iranian policy to the region. But as long as they feel that they can keep that in check, they're going to still work with Iran. And perhaps just at the end, one final comment is they know that every time they work with Iran or there's a photo opportunity or an agreement, it gets Americans upset. And if you can get an American upset, that's a good day. So we'll just leave it at that. Okay.
So before the last question from me to you, Robert, before I turn it over to the audience for their questions to the panelists. So where are we going next? Assuming in the best case situation, there is a deal. You know, it's a military deal. So can that translate into the political space? And for that to translate into the political space, what does it need to be in place? What do we need to have in place for a deal, a cessation of fire, a cessation of hostility, humanitarian assistance, to lead to the negotiations and to the negotiation track? And if you can just, you know, comment under, if there is no deal, what's next for Syrians? What's next for U.S.-Russia coordination? I know these are two big
I was going to say. In brief, I think the most optimistic outcome for Syria in the short to medium term is a ceasefire that somehow holds, and that would be miraculous by itself, but leads to the de facto partition of the country with its own drawbacks. If the ceasefire that the Americans and the Russians try to achieve, sorry, I'm not using the term of art, cessation of hostilities. If it does not hold, then you just have fighting like we have seen in Syria now, with all of the tragedies associated with that. I think it highly unlikely that a cessation of hostilities that does not have some kind of a monitoring mechanism, it's bound not to hold. I don't think the Syrian government is prepared to relinquish its claims to the parts of Syria it does not control, whether that be eastern Aleppo, whether that be the suburbs of Damascus, whether that be parts of Qunaitre province in the south, not far from Israel, or the huge spanses of territory in eastern Syria that are outside its control. I do not think the Syrian government is prepared over the long term to cede control of those. On this, I take Bashar al-Assad at his word, and he's been very plain about it and sometimes aggravated the Russians in the process. And at the same time, the Syrian armed opposition is trying to change a police state. And they're trying to change a police state because they don't dare go home as long as that police state is still there. Let me ask a question to the audience. Watch the news, informed audience. How many of you would trust taking your families back to what remains of your apartment in, let's just say, Homs or Aleppo, knowing that the four secret police agencies that used to be able to pick up anybody they wanted without any accountability whatsoever are still very much there and have your names down as armed opposition. But they say they won't bother you. How many of you would trust your lives and your family's lives to that promise? Show of hands. Okay. Well, I have to tell you, I've asked that question of armed opposition people myself in the last 2 years, and their response is pretty much like yours. And so without the kind of political security sector reforms that I talked about, I don't really see how you end the fighting. We've asked the Russians about this in our unofficial discussions with the Middle East Institute. And security sector reform, they sort of understand the concept, but they certainly don't have a plan for it. And when we asked them what they thought about reconstruction of Syria, they certainly didn't have a plan for that either. I'm not saying the Americans have great plans for post-ceasefire Syria. I'm not sure that they do. But I do know the Russians seem to have none, because it's a military problem. It's a military problem. And so, Rhonda, as I look out into the future, I see a partition which will be hard to hold, given the Syrian government and the Syrian armed opposition's attitudes, would depend on having a monitoring force on the ground, which is not in the offing. The UN deployed a monitoring force in 2012 under Norwegian General Moon, 400 unarmed observers, and they were there for about 3 months and gave up in frustration with Kofi Annan. I just don't see how this goes anywhere, which goes back to what I said before about the so what. This is not just about bombing Nusra and the Islamic State. This is a much deeper question. Henry's talked about the Kurdish angle. This is a much deeper, more complex problem.
Thank you. Now, we'll turn over, sir, and we have to wait for the microphone because we are taping this and they are coming around. So, you go first. Yes, sir. And please tell your name and to whom are you addressing the question?
Robert Friedman, Johns Hopkins University. Actually, 2 points. Henri, thank you very much. It was a very coherent presentation, actually, well understood. 2 days ago, both the Turkish foreign minister and the Turkish defense minister were quoted as saying they are interested in going to Raqqa. And Ash Carter, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, is also quoted as possible cooperation. Is this, from the Turkish perspective, just blowing smoke? Question number one. And to my other two friends up there, I come from the Cold War II mentality. Let me be very clear about that. Can't you make an argument the Russians want to keep this going? They've got a beautiful base now, protected by SAM 400s. They've got an enlarged naval base. They're major players, as you have said. And what is it? How is it to their advantage to see it ended? Now, I agree with Robert that, at least I think, when the Russians announced the partial withdrawal, that was immediately after Assad said he wanted to take over all of Syria, and this was a clear signal to him. But do the Russians really want a solution to this?
I will take one more question from this side, and then you'll answer these two questions, and then we go again and do another round. Yes, please.
A PRP intel analyst and a former diplomat. Syria used to be an excellent market for Russian weapons, but now it's losing beaucoup rubles on any transfer of arms, which boils down the interest of Russia to basically wanting to kill as many Russian-speaking terrorists as they can in Syria before they return home to Russia and Central Asia, number one. And number two, preserving the submarine base at Tartus and the airstrip that protects it at Latakia. Couldn't we advance the process by offering the Russians maintenance of those military assets in exchange for letting go of al-Assad, who is, after all, a minority leader? Russia supported majority rule in South Africa, and they should be encouraged to do so in Syria. Can we make that deal with the Russians?
I'll start with Robert. You pick questions. Well, maybe this is the last question.
I think both Robert Friedman and Peter have asked a question about the Russian relations with the Assad regime, and do you want to keep it going? This is my sense from both official discussions with the Russians and also unofficial. I don't think this is about their military facilities. I think they're concerned about that, but I don't think this is essentially that. If I understand the Russian position correctly on the fighting and the regime, it is that the Syrian regime is actually brittle, and Bashar al-Assad is not perfect, but were you to remove him and the little circle around him, what's left of the Syrian state would crumble a la Baghdad 2003. That there's, try as they might to figure out some alternative construct to get a stable government in Damascus, they can't imagine it. And what they do not want, which ties into your point about killing Russian-speaking terrorists in Syria, is they don't want that central state, what's left of it, to crumble, and then the task of applying the military solution that they want is even more difficult. One could argue about whether or not the state is so brittle in the case of Saddam's Iraq and the way the Americans went in. It certainly proved to be. Whether or not that has to be the case in Syria, we could discuss. I don't think, Robert Friedman, they want the fighting to continue necessarily, but I do think they are willing to help the Bashar al-Assad-led government survive because they don't see an alternative to Assad. I guess I couldn't share this in public. My former boss, Assistant Secretary Beth Jones, is here, and she's going to slap me. But and I don't have diplomatic immunity anymore. It's tragic. But Lavrov once said to me in one of our meetings, he knew about me, and you know I'd been in Iraq 5 years, and he said, "We don't need any more of your social engineering like Iraq." And I thought that spoke volumes about how the Russians perceived the American experience and failure in Iraq, and also their sense of their own limitations about Syria. And I'm not saying he's wrong. I think they believe that, much as you might dislike him, Bashar al-Assad is sort of the indispensable man. And I don't mean just him, but this ruling clique of, I don't know, 15 to 20 people. They can't figure out how do you remove them and still keep the rest of the state operational.
And if I might add, based on the unofficial dialogue, is that also the intervention in Libya was basically raised the major red flag for them because mm-hmm. it reminded them that, you know, the U.S. is at it again, starting mm-hmm. with social engineering, and we better nip it in the bud. You know, they tried it in Libya, and we are not going to let them try it again in Syria. And that was driver of their intervention in Syria.
I would say exactly. Following on this and tying in both sets of questions, which dovetail well, it is exactly that narrative of Afghanistan 2001, Iraq 2003, Libya. And now we're going to go to Syria. And they look at it as failure, failure, failure.
Correct.
We're going to have a failure if the leader is taken out and no viable alternative is put in. And repeatedly in Russian, you know, discourse, it's who's next, who's the alternative. Yeah. You even draw up a mythical scenario of someone within the Alawite community, and they go, yeah, that's fine, but you're creating, you know, that's not a sustainable argument until we actually see a real alternative. So they're going to stick with him. It serves them well regionally in terms of their perception. On the military front, and it's interesting, there's been a lot of discussion, particularly in American military circles, about kind of what's the value of this engagement. And again, sort of in unofficial discussions with Russian counterparts, the reality is, at its basis, and I know this might sound a bit crass, but it's a great testing ground for live fire operations. It's a fantastic way to get your pilots hours in the air. Prior to these campaigns, and let's go say, prior to the Georgian campaign in 2008, Your typical Russian pilot, you know, would just get, you know, a couple dozen hours in a week or a month, you know, depending on how much fuel they had. They're able to ramp it up in the mid part of last decade. And we saw actually in the Georgian campaign in 2008 how bad they were. It was internally, there was a lot of discussion post conflict analysis of where did our military go wrong in what should have been not even a conflict, right? And so they rethink this. We're now 8 years on, and we see the fruits of the labor. We see the fruits of this engagement. And so we now have not just pilots, we have their missile forces. How can they deploy units on the ground, the S-400s, the transportation, logistics. Yes, they're even working humanitarian assistance and even getting musicians to Palmyra. So, you know, all of these operations, they look at it with a pat on the back, and believe it or not, there's an operational benefit. We see this in our military when we do humanitarian operations in this country or that country. The Russians now have this opportunity in Syria. Again, that's a small component of it, but I think an important one. A second is also, as they engage with partners in the region, a chance to show their qualities, to show their ability to conduct operations. The irony is, when they show videos of their successful air operations, on occasion they simply borrow ours. They just don't show the platform from which the bombs, missiles, et cetera, dropped. They say, look how successful we've been. And the American analysts go, yeah, we saw that as well. But it does resonate because ultimately it's the perception in the region and the Russian perception of the Russians has been fairly positive.
Thank you. All you.
Bob, the kindest way I can say is that none of these gentlemen are authoritative. I don't think they talk for Erdogan. I think it's like, you know, when there's a missile coming in, you throw chafe to divert the missile from hitting its target. That's all they're doing. They're just creating noise out there. It's not serious.
All right. Margaret. Microphone, please.
Thank you. Margaret Warner from the PBS NewsHour, and this is really for Robert Kangas, but anyone else. If there were U.S.-Russian military cooperation, they say right now it's just deconfliction. Mm-hmm. One, you indicated it's more than that, but two, what would it actually look like operationally? What are we talking about?
Another question? Shall we take? Yes, sir. Here.
Thank you, sir. This is Nasir Hafiz. I'm from South Asia Studies at Johns Hopkins. My question is that if you look at the title of today's event, that, you know, how Russia and American cooperate to solve the puzzle, which is so far not, you know, we are not totally understanding what actually is on ground, and unfortunately, we have not been able to figure out what is going to be the alternative or a better solution from the present situation. My question is that, you know, if you look at Syria from purely geostrategic perspective, so it appears that, you know, there is a struggle going on and, you know, different powers are playing. But in fact, there's a humanitarian crisis also. So my question is that what United Nations or what other organizations can do, or, you know, so many humanitarian organizations are out there. So how can that factor be brought into the conflict to draw more cooperation, to get out of the power struggle that is for interest-based alone for a humanitarian crisis? Thank you.
Thank you. You take this question. Thanks. Maybe Robert will take
that. Actually, very, very straightforward on the U.S.-Russian military cooperation. And if I gave the impression that it's more than deconfliction, I'll sort of scale that back a bit, because right now that's the vast majority of the cooperation is really just trying to sort out flight lines and who's going where. And as we see, and in fact, I think even what yesterday, the day before, we're only 10 feet away, isn't that nice? You know, I will say we're going to have to put up with that, because it's very much a Russian game to see how they can test our ability to remain reserved and not frustrated when they come that close to us. Again, back to the testing equipment thing, but it's also maybe a machismo moment among pilots. But with that, what would real cooperation look like? Well, first of all, it would have to entail a clear understanding of who the targets on the ground are. And as we've been saying, that isn't happening. We'd like to think we know who the quote-unquote bad guys are, or the, you know, whether it's particularly Daesh, you know, we will target this group. For the Russian forces, if we're believing the statistics that are coming out, what, 70-80% of ordnances are falling on non-terrorist, non-extremist groups, they're not going to pull back from that, because again, that gets all the way back to their notion of supporting the Assad regime, and they're going after the communities or constituencies that would cause most damage to him. Until we can actually get an understanding of who the target is, we're not going to have cooperation. I mean, we think back to the last time we really worked together, the Great Patriotic War, World War II. Believe it or not, there were still deconfliction moments and serious policy differences. And as a result, the narratives that came out of that war, even today, still differ radically. The Russian perception today of how we didn't cooperate with them is sort of standard fare. And so something as simple or basic, I should say simple, but as concentrated as the Syrian conflict, we're probably not getting past that first stage. The humanitarian effort, whether it's cooperative humanitarian, not corridors, not unilaterally declared humanitarian corridors, that could be an area for cooperation. And I would say, for those who may have had experience in the Bosnian campaign, or post-Bosnian, stabilization efforts, there were moments of U.S.-Russian cooperation. Again, in humanitarian efforts, intelligence sharing, et cetera. So we can actually look to a moment where, again, in a limited instance, it happened, but it was specific, it was driven by a few people and constantly worked on with the regular moments of failure. And unfortunately, I see that as the norm here.
Thank you. Robert, can you just comment quickly on what Roger said in terms of agreeing on the targets? That requires of the U.S. to do the, what you told me some time ago, demarbling, right? Separating, yeah. You know, the good guys from the bad guys.
Yeah.
I mean, is that something that's feasible now? Are we in a stage where we can separate the good guys from the bad guys? Is it doable? You know, I mean, we can talk about it, but on the ground, is it doable?
Well, I'd actually love to hear what Charles thinks about this, too, but I'll hazard a not-so-informed guess. The overall trend in the Syrian armed opposition as the fight gets more and more desperate is to conglomerate into more loose alliances that include this Al-Qaeda affiliate. Not because they like the Al-Qaeda affiliate. They don't. Not because they trust the Al-Qaeda affiliate. They don't. Not because they've always had wonderful relations with the Al-Qaeda affiliate. They haven't. In many cases, they've been attacked by that Al-Qaeda affiliate, which they're now cooperating with. It's just that whereas 20% of their experience with the Al-Qaeda affiliate is bad, 100% of their experience with the Assad government is bad. And so they've just decided, as a purely tactical survival strategy, to work more and more with this Al-Qaeda affiliate, now called Fatah Sham. The demarbling, I think, is actually getting harder with the passage of time, simply because the armed opposition on the ground, which had managed to connect physically into the besieged pocket in East Aleppo, they've lost that ground now, and they've lost ground in suburban Damascus. And so from their perspective, they're losing. I think that perspective is probably accurate in a way. And so demarbling is harder than ever. The American threat to just go ahead and bomb the Nusra positions, and if other opposition groups are in the way, that's too bad, they should have moved out of the way, I think will just further reduce any American leverage over the armed opposition were we to ever get to a political negotiating table. And it will, by contrast, raise the leverage of countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey, on whom they will be ever more dependent. But actually, could we ask Charles what you think?
Charles, can you raise your voice? Can you give him the microphone to comment?
This is unusual.
Why not? Go ahead.
I agree. I think everything Robert said is right.
That's why I wanted to ask you.
the reality is on the ground that the armed opposition groups with which we work and we continue to work on a limited basis believe that the international community is now part of a conspiracy against their revolution. And we now are faced with this horrible reality whereby yesterday a drone strike from some country killed one of the most senior members of this former or current Al-Qaeda affiliate, their military leader. And we now see basically the entirety of the opposition coming out mourning his death. Why? Because he was responsible for breaking the siege of Aleppo whilst the international community watched and did nothing. And so, yeah, it's become very normal now to hear very reasonable nationalist individuals within the opposition say that Al-Qaeda is a far more effective ally than the West, and why should we consider anything different? And as Robert said, it's not because they like them, but it's just a simple day-to-day strategy for survival.
Thank you. Now, on the humanitarian questions, Robert, the question was, how can we factor it into our discussions more? How can it be a basis for common ground action more?
Your question is a fair one. Two levels of response. As part of this negotiation that Kerry and Lavrov are conducting, there seems to be a discussion about a humanitarian aid corridor into this pocket of East Aleppo as well as government-controlled West Aleppo through a route called the Costello Road. And the Russians have actually offered to station soldiers on that road, ground forces. Not a lot, but some. And, you know, they'll be at some risk. They're going into a war zone. They want the Americans to guarantee that the opposition won't shoot at them. I refer back to the leverage over the opposition that I was just talking about and Charles was talking about. On one level, the Russians appear to be cooperative. But on the other hand, the experience with the Russians, the hard experience with the Russians is that when the Syrian government repeatedly violated UN Security Council Resolution 2254 from earlier this year, the Russians did not want to move to any kind of serious response to the Syrian government. No additional sanctions, no promises to maybe cut arms until they reopened corridors or whatever. And consequently, people starved to death in places like Madaya. And the Russians watched. I'm not saying they welcomed it, but they accepted it as the cost of preserving the Assad government, which is their number one priority. Humanitarian aid is not their number one priority. It's not even number two, probably not even number three. I'm not saying they're against humanitarian aid. I'm just saying it's not a priority. And the Russians are quite tough about following priorities one, two, and three. And I have to say, this is made even more difficult by a Syrian government which has absolutely no interest or concern about the civilian populations in occupied parts, opposition-controlled parts of the country. None. Zero. The Syrian government is completely disinterested. And that makes any Russian task of convincing the Syrian government to act in a halfway responsible manner even harder. And do the Russians really want to spend their few nickels on that? And as much as the United Nations or the United States or Ban Ki-moon or anybody complains about it, the Syrian government isn't going to move it. And the Russians have very limited leverage. Is that really where they want to spend their effort?
One last round of questions. I think you wanted to ask a question, or no? Not anymore? Okay, sir. Yes.
My name is Emre Lausu from Virginia International University. My question is to Ari Barki. When we think of Turks and Turkish reaction to Kurds, they kind of waited up until the Kurds tried to come to the Euphrates River. And what is so important for Turkey to keep the Kurds the east of Euphrates River, but not the west? Why didn't, in other words, why didn't they just start intervening at around Kobani or east of Kobani, like Kamishle? Why is this Euphrates is so important?
Well, look, first of all, when Kobani occurred, the Turks were not ready. It came as a big surprise. They never thought that the United States was going to intervene. And as you know, Erdogan said at the time, Kobani is about to fall in a very gleeful way. And then came the big shock. So they had to adjust policies after that. But by the time they adjusted, the Kurds already had taken most of the eastern parts of the Euphrates. The reason they don't want for the Kurds to cross the Euphrates, there's two areas. There's Afrin in the western part of northern Syria, which is controlled by the Kurds. And then you have the eastern parts of Hasakeh and Kobani, that area. So there's a gap. And what the Turks are afraid of is that the Kurds will take that gap, which is not, by the way, majority Kurdish, but create essentially a contiguous territory all the way from the Iraqi border to the Turkish border in Antakya. So you'll have essentially the making of another KRG, this time a KRG controlled by the PKK, and that's basically why they don't want it. But ideally, I think ultimately they think they will be able to somehow push back the Kurds from the eastern parts as well. But that's, we'll see as the strategy develops. It depends on what happens domestically as well.
Hello. Yeah, Tolga Tanis with Hürriyet. About the meeting in Geneva between Lavrov and Secretary Kerry, what are they discussing, and what is the main topic that they are discussing? The Secretary Kelly will stay on Monday as well. What is the most challenging topic that they are discussing? And secondly, what will be the limits of Russians in terms of the territory in Syria? Would they be okay, for example, if all the Sunni groums will stay in Idlib, Homs, or Bab el-Salam, Bab el-Hab? What will be the limit in terms of the Sunnis, and what will be the limit for the Kurds? From Russian perspective, would they be okay if they unite the cantons?
I think we'll start with Robert saying, what are they discussing? Roger, what are the limits for Russia? And then, what are the limits for Turkey? Is that okay? Yeah. Roger.
Well, Robert, first, I'm not in the discussion, so I can't tell you exactly what they're discussing. I would say it appears to me that they're discussing as a first step a cessation of hostilities and access into at least Aleppo, if not other besieged communities. And I think the hard part they're having is what we call sequencing. That is to say, what's step one? What is step two? What is step three? What is step four? And we know some of the elements that have to be agreed upon in terms of sequencing. Syrian government is to stop bombing civilian areas. Armed opposition is to stop fighting. There will be continued operations against the Fatahsham, the affiliate of Al-Qaeda, and the Islamic State. These will continue. Humanitarian aid deliveries will commence. What is the order that you put those things in? And there may be other elements, such as deployment of Russian forces, maybe withdrawal of certain kinds of weapons and or certain forces from defined areas. And so you could see there are a lot of different elements, and what is step one and what is step two and how much time between step one and step two. I do take the administration at its word when it says it doesn't have a lot of trust in the Russians. They try to cessation of hostilities. They tried a cessation of hostilities in February, and it went very badly, almost immediately. It lasted, well, it never really applied countrywide. There were some parts of the country that saw a reduction in violence for a short time, a couple of weeks. So I think the Americans now have gone back and have laid out a much more detailed set of steps that have to be taken, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I think that's what they're discussing.
I think great. And actually, this ties in well with the limitations, because how that sequencing goes, of course, is Russia's going to want to make sure, I should say the Russian leadership will want to make sure that it, if not stays in their favor, or at least is partial to the current regime in Damascus, doesn't go so far against them, to use a wonderful Cold War phrase. They don't want the correlation of forces to go in the wrong direction, that is, for the Sunni opposition. And so I think from the Russian perspective, they will, all of the issues raised here are going to be important. Two key limitations, though, that need to be factored in. One is actually the amount of money and troops that they can put in. And as much as I've said, oh, they're doing this on the cheap, it's, you know, low cost, high return, etc., there's a limit to that. And ultimately, if they have to put in more troops, this is going to become a costly venture. And if they don't see an end in sight, problematic. They've been down that road before, and I don't want to say, oh, this will be a repeat of Afghanistan. We're not looking at that. But a commitment to a foreign engagement where they're not sure the end result and if the cost-benefit will be worthwhile, because let's remember, at home, the Russian economy isn't doing well. They are in a little bit of a conflict in Ukraine, and it is a conflict. They are investing men and materiel into that battle, or into that simmering event. And this is something, while there's a good visibility on it, and I would say some positive returns, they know there's a limit. And that really ties into the second limitation, which is time. From not just Putin's perspective, but the Russian government's perspective, the Russian military's perspective, quite frankly, they actually will be pushing for some early resolution of this. As much as they're comfortable with having Syria unstable, perhaps a simmering conflict going on, as long as they're engaged, they'd like to see an end. It would be a maintained presence in a more peaceful situation with Assad still in power. That's a win for Russia. And so, believe it or not, they're also looking at the clock in a different context than the Americans, but it's important none the same.
Thank you. Henri.
I'm going to take the question a little bit differently. I wonder if the Turks are being played by the Russians a little bit. I mean, I think Putin is... It's like he's probably playing three different chess games at the same time, and one of them is with the Turks. And he's, you know, he had essentially Erdogan capitulate to him. Erdogan apologized, paid compensation, went all the way to St. Petersburg. And he plays this essentially with Erdogan and tries to create a rift between the United States, even if it's more than, if it's only symbolic, it doesn't matter. And then when Erdogan wants to go further, he says, oh, no, you can't do that. He actually the Russians came up with a statement the other day basically saying they don't want the Turks to move any further south in Syria. So this notion that the Turks had that maybe they would be working with the Russians and the Russians would be sympathetic to them. No, and then in some ways, look, let's face it, the Russians and the Syrian government has played a fairly smart game with the PYD in the sense that they still pay some of the salaries of the PYD officials. They cooperate over the airport because that's the only, I mean, the PYD needs at the airport to get out.
The airport in Qamishli.
In Qamishli, because
up in the northeast. The
Iraqi Kurds are keep closing the border on them. So, you know, the Russians are playing a multi-level game here. And I think, you know, Putin goes to bed every night and says, boy, did I have fun today. You know? The one thing we haven't talked about, the only thing we haven't talked about today, I think, is, and in some ways, may not be the elephant in the room, but it's ISIS. Right? Look what happened in Jarablus. There was a very minor fight between the Turks and Turkish-supported militias and ISIS. ISIS kind of disappeared. I don't know where they went. I don't know what the game is. And we haven't talked about ISIS, and we are kind of assuming that these guys are, boom, they're not a factor anymore. And they'll come up somewhere and they will surprise us and surprise everybody. And that's something to worry about.
Well, on this very cheerful note, well, I would like to thank our panelists for a fascinating, very rich discussion. Thank you very much.